Welcome back to the program. We live in a world in which we praise logic and reason, yet to a large extent we are ruled by our emotions. Moreover, new research shows the power of emotion, and that to a very real extent we would do just as well making decisions and making choices from emotions rather than reason. But what do we really understand about how the emotional system works? What are the genetic and biochemical components, and can we define and maybe even change our emotional style? These are some of the areas of cutting-edge work being done by our guest, Richard Davidson. Dr. Richard Davidson is the William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry and Director of the Weissman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and the Laboratory for Effective Neuroscience and Founder and Chair of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the Weissman Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Richard Davidson here to talk about his newest work, The Emotional Life of Your Brain. Richard Davidson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. In many ways, you talk about the fact that how we respond to emotion, the various ways in which we respond to emotional stimuli, that it's different for each of us. In many ways, it's like an individual fingerprint.
It is very much like a fingerprint. Each of us, as I describe in my book, each of us has these six emotional styles or dimensions of responding, but we differ in where we fall along each of these dimensions. And where we fall along each of these dimensions defines our unique emotional style. And this is perhaps the most salient characteristic of emotion, that people respond differently to life's slings and arrows. And that is the substance of the book and the substance of the 30-plus year career of neuroscientific research on emotion that I've conducted.
But the overlay to that is that this is not a static condition. It's not that we evolve one way or we develop one way in terms of how we respond, but because of neuroplasticity, as you talk about, we in fact are constantly changing the various ways we respond on that emotional, in those emotional styles, based upon the things that happen to us.
Yes, that's exactly right. So each of these dimensions or styles of emotion is rooted in different brain circuits, and we know that these brain circuits exhibit what we call plasticity. They can change in response to experience and in response to training. And one of the points that I make in the book is that we are wittingly or unwittingly continuously being influenced by events around us, and our brains are constantly being shaped. And we can take more responsibility for our own brain by cultivating more positive habits of mind. And we can do this if we find that our emotional styles are not functioning as well for us as we might like.
Is this a conscious process? Can we take it upon ourselves to shift our various emotional styles? Or is this something that happens as a result of what happens to us?
It's both. So what happens to us that we may not be aware of, that's sort of operating under the hood, so to speak, those influences are constantly shaping our brain. But we can also engage in a more deliberate and conscious effort to cultivate certain qualities that will change our brain in systematic ways. And this is the substance of research that I've conducted along with my colleagues over the last 10 years in particular, where we've shown that simple methods like, for example, simple methods derived from meditation traditions can be used to change our brain in very specific ways.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you have found is that these changes in emotional style literally show up in brain imagery.
Yes, they do, and we're very fortunate to have available the latest tools that modern technology and science has developed to investigate the inner workings of the brain. These are tools that were not available 10 years ago, but we can now peer into the brain and we can look at its detailed structure and function completely non-invasively with MRI, magnetic resonance imaging technology. And this allows us to actually track how interventions that we can present to a person may actually change his or her brain over time.
What do we know about the role of genetics in how we evolve with respect to our emotional style, and more importantly, how that genetics and this whole field of epigenetics really allows us to make these shifts?
Yeah, those are wonderful questions. There's no question that there are genetic influences that may be detectable early in life that predispose us towards certain emotional dispositions. That seems quite clear. But it's also clear that those influences are modest, that the environment also plays a very big role. And here's where the field of epigenetics comes in. Epigenetics refers to the regulation of the expression of our genes. Mm-hmm. So while we're all born with a specific sequence of base pairs that constitute our DNA, the extent to which genes are turned on or turned off is actually influenced by our environment, by our experience, and by our training. And so we literally can shape the extent to which genes are turned on or turned off by what we do, by our behavior, by the environments to which we are exposed.
But are there limits to that? In other words, do we all have within us, within our genetic makeup, an infinite number of possibilities, or are there limits within the genetic makeup each of us have?
I believe there are definitely limits. I think it would be really irresponsible to suggest that there are not. We don't exactly know at this point in time what those limits are. We don't know to what extent training can produce epigenetic modification that really is enduring. All of these are questions that are being actively investigated in rigorous scientific research today. But I think it's clear that there are going to be constraints. But it's also clear, in my view, that we haven't yet tapped the potential of epigenetic plasticity that may be environmentally produced.
Mm-hmm. To what extent is there a difference in terms of the way our emotional makeup shifts and changes as a result of influence, in terms of how we react to situations versus how we proactively act in different situations?
Well, those are both important characteristics. So we can proactively prepare for certain kinds of situations, and through that process, we can then modulate our response to those situations. So, for example, something that most listeners, I'm sure, have experienced is going to get a vaccination where they have a, they'll get a shot and they know what that feels like. And we all either consciously or unconsciously prepare for that and can attenuate the pain or help modulate the pain that is very brief by preparing for it in advance. We also have mechanisms that help us regulate our emotions after a challenge has occurred. Some of us can come back to baseline more quickly. Mm-hmm. Some of us come back more slowly. This is actually one of the emotional styles that I talk about in my book, and I call it the resilience style. People who are resilient are able to recover from adversity more quickly. And those who have a very difficult time recovering are individuals who are predisposed towards certain kinds of disorders. That's something that we can actually learn to influence, and we can learn to become more resilient through certain kinds of training.
Is there a biochemical element to this, and can we influence any of this in a biochemical way?
The brain certainly is a biochemical machine, and there's a whole soup of molecules that constitute transmitters that operate between neurons, that modulate activity of neuronal populations. So all of these circuits that I talk about in the book are importantly influenced and use a whole variety of molecules in their operation. And because of that, it is indeed possible to affect the circuitry of particular parts of the brain through chemical manipulations, through taking a drug. But in most cases, drugs are a blunt instrument. And the reason for that is that these molecules are typically found in many different places in the brain. And so it's very hard to achieve a very specific effect through medication compared to effects which can be achieved with much greater specificity, I believe, through behavioral interventions, through interventions that do not involve taking a pill. And that's because, again, the molecules that we affect through drugs are ones that are present in many different places throughout the brain, and thus it's kind of affecting the brain with a fairly blunt instrument.
And this is the whole area where the whole field of cognitive therapy has evolved.
Right, that's precisely right. So cognitive therapy is one of the most well-validated psychological treatments for depression and other kinds of disorders and for improving well-being. And there is now modern research which indicates that cognitive therapy actually produces very specific effects on the brain. The effects that it produces are probably more specific than any effect that can be produced through antidepressant medication. Now, having said all this, I'd like to just add that I'm not someone who's anti-medication. Mm-hmm. I believe that there are certainly cases where medication use, judicious medication use, may be warranted, but I also think that many psychiatric medications are overprescribed in our culture, and we can achieve comparable, if not even more enduring effects through non-pharmacological interventions that have many fewer side effects.
What have we learned, and what does it tell us about this whole field in looking at the differences, the emotional differences between men and women?
Well, there are unquestionably differences between men and women in aspects of brain circuitry that relate to emotion that may help us to better understand why there are gender differences, for example, in the prevalence of certain psychiatric conditions. We know that after adolescence, depression is about twice as common in women as in men, for example. Autism is many more times commonly found in boys than in girls. Those gender differences may be understood based upon some knowledge of brain function, although I should say that for the dimensions that I talk about in my book concerning emotional style, while there are certainly some mild, slight gender differences in some of those styles, for the most part, the differences within a gender across individuals are far greater than any difference between men and women.
Of the six categories, are there those categories, resilience, outlook, intuition, awareness, among the six categories, are there ones where there is a wider range of the extremes?
Wider range of the extreme? Well, I don't really believe so, based on our current knowledge. There is a fairly wide range among all six of these categories. In every one of these categories, we can find sort of pathological extremes that represent a very wide range.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about depression and how understanding the things we've been talking about the emotional aspect of the brain, can help us in better understanding how depression works.
Certainly. So with depression, let me talk about two of the emotional styles that I describe in the book. One of them we call resilience, and another we call outlook. So the resilience style, as I mentioned briefly earlier, refers to how quickly or slowly a person recovers from adversity. An individual who is depressed, on average, has a difficult time recovering from adversity. So when something bad happens, rather than being able to come back to baseline quickly, someone who is depressed or who is prone to depression will perseverate with their negative emotion. They'll often ruminate, which makes it difficult for them to return quickly back to baseline. The other style that's relevant to depression is the outlook style. And the outlook style refers to the extent to which positive emotion persists. So when something good happens, for some of us, it provides a glow that can last for hours. Whereas for others of us, when something good happens, we may have a very short-term burst of positive emotion, but then it quickly subsides. And again, for someone with depression or someone who's prone to depression, they're unable to sustain the positive emotion over time. So they may experience a brief moment of positive emotion, but it very, very quickly dissipates. So those two styles are very relevant to our understanding of depression.
And as we understand the changes that can be made in these various emotional styles, as we talked about earlier, to what extent are those changes, or do they become permanent changes, or is there always the risk that we go back to kind of our genetic baseline?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, it depends upon what the source is of the change that is facilitating the transformation of that emotional style. So one of the ways in which these emotional styles can be changed is through simple behavioral practices. They may be simple meditation techniques or techniques derived from cognitive therapy. And, you know, I think the answer to the question about whether these changes endure is really an answer that I think most listeners would readily understand with the analogy to physical exercise. If you were someone that was out of shape and then you engaged in a systematic program of physical exercise, say for a month, I think most people would agree that if you exercise regularly for the month, you would notice a change in your body and physical health. Now, if you stopped exercising after that 1 month, those changes are not going to endure forever. They will dissipate. And similarly, if you stop exercising your mind, so to speak, engaging in mental exercise to transform your emotional style, I think it's likely that the changes will not endure as well. And so what we're talking about here is mental exercise that is very much analogous to physical exercise. And I would say that if you continue to practice, the changes not only are likely to endure, but evidence that we have suggests that they actually will be enhanced over time. But if you stop practicing, I think that the evidence suggests that they will not endure.
I mean, I guess the other part of the analogy is whether or not you like exercise, and if you begin a program of it because your doctor tells you to, and even if you see results, there's always the tendency to sort of fall off the wagon, so to speak, and go back to not exercising.
That's right. And one of the things that I do in the last chapter of my book is offer a whole bunch of simple exercises that people can try if they wish to change any one of the emotional style dimensions. And the reason I present several is for the very reason that you're suggesting. One size does not fit all. Just as there are different emotional styles across individuals, there are different methods that may be used to modulate or modify those emotional styles, and what's best for one person may not be best for others. And so it's important that an individual finds what seems right for her or himself to transform emotional styles in the way they may wish.
What do we know about the influence of our physical environment with respect to shifting and shaping these various emotional components?
Well, we certainly know a lot about our social environment. So For example, mothers who are more nurturant will induce changes in the brains of their offspring that actually promote well-being. And so those are very important environmental influences, those changes can actually result in epigenetic modifications that have been studied. In terms of other characteristics of the environment, there certainly have been studies and various research programs devoted to different aspects of the environment and the role they may play in modulating the neural circuits that underlie our emotional style. There are all kinds of environmental effects that range from toxins in the environment to noise in the environment to the amount of sunshine that we may be exposed to the kind of food we eat. So the list is virtually endless. These are all influences which can potentially modulate our brain. Many of these influences we don't have much control over. And one of the whole points of the book is that what we do have control over is our own mind. We do have the opportunity to influence our mind in how it responds to the environment, and this is where we have the leverage. The strategies that I recommend, while some of the strategies involve shifting around your environment, again, there's just often limits to what we can do there, but we can influence how our mind responds to emotional challenges around us, and through those mechanisms influence our emotional style.
Which brings us back to the nexus between thought and emotion and how they play against each other, and as you talk about, the way in which, even in the prefrontal cortex, the way in which they come together.
Right. That's a hugely important topic, and you mentioned the prefrontal cortex. This is an area of the brain that has evolved most recently over the course of evolution, and it's the area where thought and emotion come together. The idea that thought and emotion are somehow antagonistic is really kind of an anachronistic idea. The brain doesn't respect that distinction. It integrates thought and emotion seamlessly, and through our thought we can influence our emotion, and through our emotions we influence our thought. The influences are bidirectional, but we can certainly regulate our emotions using cognitive strategies that turn out to be extremely useful, simple, and very powerful.
Is it foolish, then, when we talk about trying to bring pure logic, pure reason, into the equation, to separate it out entirely from an emotional response?
Yes, I think it is foolish because it flies in the face of everything we know about how the brain is wired. The brain doesn't make those kinds of distinctions. And, you know, when we think about complex decisions that we make in life, like, for example, the decision to marry a particular partner, those decisions are not made on the basis of a cold cognitive calculus. They're not made on the basis of simple logic. They're made by consulting our emotions. And if we did not have our emotions to consult, we would be very impaired in our ability to make those kinds of decisions.
Richard Davidson, his book is The Emotional Life of Your Brain. Richard, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.